Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey, I'm Jake Brennan, and I want to tell you about Disgraceland, the award-winning music and true crime podcast that I host. Disgraceland tells the stories of musicians getting away with murder and behaving very badly. Fleetwood Mac, Nipsey Hussle, Cardi B, Ozzy Osbourne, Taylor Swift, Tupac, The Beatles, Amy Winehouse, Jay-Z, The Grateful Dead, and so many more. This is not the music history you've heard before. This is an uncensored, immersive look at the lives of musical icons as seen through the crimes they've committed or that have been perpetrated against them. Did Jerry Lee Lewis murder his fifth wife? What really happened to Sam Cooke in that seedy motel at 3 a.m.? And how did the Rolling Stones wind up sleeping with the First Lady? Wait, what? New episodes of Disgraceland drop every Tuesday with bonus episodes released on Mondays and Thursdays. So get in, buckle up, and join me in Disgraceland. Available right now, wherever you get your podcasts. Rock and roll.
Good evening, everybody. We have a special announcement before tonight's session of the Curious Creatures podcast. It's Budgie, not in Berlin, but somewhere near Bordeaux. And Lol?
Yeah, I'm still in Los Angeles. And that brings me to a topic that we could talk about Los Angeles.
Los Angeles is the album. Los Angeles is also the single, featuring LCD Sound System's front man and all-round jolly good fellow, James Murphy.
With the guy who we're going to be talking to, because our guest is none other than Jackknife Lee, who is one third of our little collective, Lol Tolhurst and Budgie and Jackknife Lee.
Yeah, so without further ado, a very big, warm, Curious Creatures welcome to Mr. Jackknife Lee.
When I'm with my kids, I don't remember the big moments, you know, let's go to Disneyland or let's go to Egypt. I like being bored, and I like what happens after those moments of boredom when you just start getting a little ridiculous and something happens. And that's the stuff you get on a tour bus. And that's the stuff that happens when you're sitting and it records you for a long time.
Hi, this is Lol Tolhurst, co-founder of The Cure.
And this is Budgie, co-founder of The Creatures, drummer with The Slits, and Susie and the Banshees.
Welcome to Curious Creatures.
Life after punk.
You may think you know the territory,
but we drew the map.
Mr. Jackknife Lee, hooray! Could I welcome you to Curious Creatures? This one's just the biggest surprise because I'm not in Berlin. I'm back in the land where I thought I'd come to retire, and I've never been as busy as I am now. Being back. Just trying to get a break from it, really. Trying to get a break from Berlin.
Why is that? Why are we so busy now?
I think it's because we had we started an album project, and then it took us up to Jackknife Studio in Topanga, and we thought it was all going to be really quick, and it was, and then it all went really slow for no good reason that we could think of. All outside our control. And the thing is that it's all coming to a head with its release now, and that album is now called Los Angeles. And we're here today to talk to Jackknife Lee, who has helped and been part of the team. We are the team. It's nice to say that we are a team.
Well, that's my job is to join teams. I never thought I'd be a joiner of things, you know, but I do enjoy teams. I'm lucky in that I don't have to do. I was thinking this today when I stopped being an artist. I realized that I didn't enjoy doing a lot of the stuff that takes you away from the reason why you're doing it in the first place, which is music. And you become, your job becomes something else. And I realize I'm not very good at that. And a lot of that is touring and promo and all that stuff. So my team joining now is always, at this point, has been kind of temporary. You know, I embed myself in systems and teams for a certain amount of time, and then we start something, finish it, and then that goes and does the other stuff, you know, the touring and the promo and all that kind of thing, which now takes people 2 years, I guess, to, you know, from album cycle to the next one. So I miss all that, and I just stay in this room where we were maybe 2 years ago or 3 years ago. The thing that did stop us momentum was a global pandemic. And then generally, it seemed that music seemed to take a while to get back up to speed again, you know. We were trying to get some label partners involved, and I think everybody was just waiting to see what happens with music in general, because the live circuit had shut down, as you know. And I think once the music in general it still feels like it's getting to grips with post-pandemic life, you know. Obviously, gigging has started again, which is great. So I think that's the thing that took us a while to figure out, and other people to figure out what we were doing. But also, it's a difficult project for people to get behind, you know. We have two drummers and a producer.
Yeah.
It's not Megan Thee Stallion and Cardi B.
I was thinking of two turntables and a microphone, but you know, that's fine. Yeah, I get you.
I met you in Berlin. You were in the swishest hotel in town.
I know. I haven't toured in about 15 years, and last year I started these shows again, and the first tour I did was with a woman from Mali called Rakia Kone, and that was like a no budget tour, hostels, all us, and gear in the back of the van. I didn't even have a seat in the van. I was sitting on the ground at the back. It wasn't quite like a splitter, but I was sitting behind the seats.
Wow.
So it was really no budget tour, but I loved doing it.
Yeah.
And then I got a call from Bono, and he doesn't do no budget tours. So he asked me if I wanted to be involved in this show that he was putting together, a book show. And I kind of misunderstood the remit or what he was expecting me to do. So I started I got the book and I started to make underscore of it for it. And then we realized that we could actually turn this into something more than a book reading. So we did alternate versions of the songs. And then the first piece I did was for a song of U2's called I Will Follow. And in the book, he's talking about, you'll know this situation very well, and I know too, when you're sitting in a rehearsal room and you're trying, somebody has an idea and they can't really articulate it, and everyone is trying to bash it out, and it causes a lot of tension, frustration, anger, a lot of yelling, maybe some tears, and hopefully a song will appear. So I decided to try and recreate the fight between the band members whilst writing I Will Follow. And then that we realized, actually, there's something in this that's more dramatic than just playing the song. Is actually, you can hear the idea forming, and then it turns into a song with a lot of arguments. So he's acting out the argument and all that kind of stuff. So we did that rehearsed for a while, and then we went on tour. We did a European and American tour, and then did a run in Broadway. So I met you in Berlin when we did that. And then the nervousness we all had was, we were doing Berlin, Paris, Madrid, Naples, but the show is in English, you know. We didn't know if it would translate, you know, the humor and the nuances, but it worked well. And luckily for me, having come off the back of the Rakia tour, which was no budget, I went from no budget to very plush hotels, and, you know, it was really nice, which I've never experienced before, you know, that luxury, but it was good.
I had had a similar experience taking my last book to South America. You know, they wanted me to give like an hour's talk by myself, you know, nobody interviewing me, by myself in Arequipa in Peru. And it was sold out, like 1,000 people. I thought, what the f*** am I going to do? Because, you know, so I spent like two nights in the hotel room, like getting everything together and writing things out and that. And then when I got on stage, I forgot all of it. And for like the first 45 seconds, I stood there thinking, oh my God, this is it. This is where I'm going to die, right here. And then I just started speaking, and they had translators in a little booth at the back who would translate it into Spanish and type it in real time over the top of the stage. And it was amazing because it worked, and it worked fine. And I had Roland bring me some, you know, a drum kit. And I sat up there and I demonstrated a couple of beats to things, you know, just like really just stuff straight off the top of my head. So it could work. People are engaged with that, just the process, you know. If I could do that, I can do anything getting out there, you know. So I'm like, I don't really suffer from stage fright. I like being out there. You know, that was probably the hardest thing. So I can sympathize with getting out there and just doing a book and trying to present it and present it in the musical way as well, you know.
I don't know many people that could speak like that for 45 minutes or an hour and be spontaneous and all that. It is a tough thing to do. Obviously, it being Bono, nothing is straightforward, and it wasn't going to be him reading from the book. You know, when he mentioned to me first, he said, I'm going to do impersonations. And, you know, I used to think, that's a terrible idea. But he did it.
Yeah.
And we had to cut some bits of the show because it was really dark. It was Rupert Murdoch.
Oh.
And it was a whole, and we were thinking of it in terms of hit singles. Like, that's the hit single of the show. You know, we were doing something, and we had to figure out how to get from one song, Where the Streets Have No Name, where he's going to sing, into the song Desire. And then we realized that there's a whole story about Harry Belafonte and Bob Geldof, and then him getting money from, or getting approval to go he needed approval to go to George Bush to get money for AIDS and stuff like that. And then he ended up having a meeting with Rupert Murdoch, and it was, you know, an interesting meeting. Anyway, so he recounts the meeting. And I had this underscore that was kind of horrifying. And Bono in early U2 shows used to this character Mephisto, which was like, you know, a Faust-like thing.
Right.
So it became that. Anyway, it was kind of outrageous, very glam, a bit camp, scary, very funny. But we just thought, this is way too weird. But that was a good one. Then he did he does Pavarotti, and then he's very good at voices. He's a good mimic.
Yeah, I know somebody who's very good as a mimic. Robert is very good at mimicking everybody in his band. He does good impersonation of me. I'll give him that. He's got it down, you know. But I've got a good impersonation of him too.
Do you want to do a bit?
That's a whole can of worms you just opened there. Well,
it involves a fair bit of sniffing, actually, with Robert. But like when he's going to say something, he wants to, you know, make a point. Every time. You watch an interview, you'll see it.
it's a strange thing that mimic or mimic, whatever. But I found the people that I met who had got close, very close to the cure, became Robert Smith.
Yeah, yes, that was a bit of a shock to me. And I did reflections to that everybody that I'd known for all these years, suddenly their hair had gone skywards and stuff, and they'd started wearing the same kind of jackets, you know, and things. Yeah. Yeah, no. It's...
Did Robert not get close to Sue and got a bit of that?
You're meaning one of my ex-colleagues.
Yeah.
I think there was certainly, what's the word? I don't know. It's beyond affection and beyond affectation and almost like the mimicry. And it was sincere. I don't think it was, you know, tongue-in-cheek humorous or anything like that. It was a definite kind of, I want to see what it feels like. You know, I think coming on stage with an early version of the Banshees.
Right.
You know, Lol was there. You were there that night.
I was there, yeah.
It was me and Lol as drums and guitar for the recently split band. I think one of my favorite clips of Robert going, you know, slipping away from the identification with Susie and Robert and where did that metamorphosis take place. But if you see a young Robert Smith playing guitar on Granada Television's So It Goes, and we're doing something like Regal Zone, and we're like a punk thrash band, and I think Robert didn't need a microphone, you know, there's no way he's going to have a microphone. And he's just kind of ambling around stage with an Ovation six string electric and really making a great reinvention of the guitar parts, you know, for those songs. So, you know, the lad's got talent. Definitely the lad's got talent. You do that in bands, don't you? All kind of, you adopt mannerisms and then there becomes, you know, the in phrases, things that happen in the team.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very hard sometimes, I think. I mean, I'm not hoping. I think we already have some little bon mots that connect us because, you know, a lot of people would come on the tour bus with the Cure and wouldn't be able to understand frigging word we were saying to each other because it was always done in little, you know, like little events that happen on the road, little things that happen, people's personalities, quirks and stuff, you know, which become, I mean, I get it. Jack Knife about being on the road, it's like we had Julianne Reagan on here a little while ago, and she said it's like the most unnatural thing for, you know, groups of people to make all the music together and then travel together all the time for months on end and then come home and not actually spend any time apart from each other, always be on top of each other. And both me and Budgie, and I'm imagining you, we did that for most of our youth, when it's the hardest time as well, where you've got the least understanding of what the world is and how to go about it. I mean, I'm actually looking forward with this new album to going out on the road because I think it'll be much more civilized and sort of, you know, civilized kind of presentation and experience.
No innuendo.
No innuendo, yeah. Right, yes.
I think that's what makes bands so special is when it works, it is great. And there's certainly a gang-like quality to the best bands. And, you know, they build their own culture. And I think that's what's exciting. When from the outside, it looks exclusive. And I think your bands both had that. They had a very strong identity that a lot of other bands didn't quite manage to get.
Right.
That's what you're looking for in bands. And that's kind of what I'm missing in music nowadays, I think, is that group. You know, I think individuals are fine. I mean, records have been made by individuals a lot, but there's a lot of individuals making music. And I guess they make temporary bands, you know, people like me join for a while, but it's not the same because you don't develop your own language. And it is like a family. The bits when I'm with my kids, I don't like, not that I don't like, I don't remember the big moments, you know, let's go to Disneyland or let's go to Egypt. I like being bored, and I like what happens after those moments of boredom when you just start getting a little ridiculous and something happens. And that's the stuff you get on a tour bus. And that's the stuff that happens when you're sitting and it records you for a long time. And yes, it's tough, and it is, Julianne is totally correct, it is an absurd collective and group. You're relying on each other for financially, for creativity, for support, you know, and it's just a very unusual dynamic. It's not like being on an oil rig, because that's a constant turnaround of people. This is like 4 to 5 people, 3 people all together, all the time.
Right.
Driving each other mad and having the greatest time of your life together. So it's a very strange dynamic that is dying, I think, for the most part. I can't think of a lot of new bands coming out that have it. I've worked with bands that don't get on very well. And it's a real shame because finding ways to get over these difficulties and still be creative and still respect each other is really wonderful if you can last the distance. But a lot of people can't actually last the distance now.
Yeah, it's like a lesson that you kind of can't learn until you've done it. You know, it's like you can't learn that it's like, okay, to keep this thing going, to keep it working, and that you have to be not like a psychotherapist, but you have to understand people's personalities and people's the way that they're thinking about it, and you have to have that respect for it, because without the respect that nothing works. I mean, when we started with the Cure, a lot of it was like, you know, like the gang mentality, like you said. I'm sure it was like that in the Banshees at several points, and it was us against the world, you know, and that works out all right for a while, and then suddenly, you know, you start to look at things and think, well, some parts of the world are not actually that bad. Some parts of the world I like and I'd like to be part of. And when you try and mingle those two things together, then it becomes difficult, because it's like a jilted teenage girlfriend or something. They're like, well, why do you want to hang out with them when isn't it enough to be with us? And, you know, all that kind of stuff comes in, which is kind of, you know, the teenage mentality. It's about how to keep that creative idea and idiom in your soul, so that you're not just doing things by rote, but it's also how to evolve with that. And that's what I really liked about what we've just done, because we've all got to that certain part, what is it ever it is, you know, the third act or whatever, and we're able to take all those lessons from the first two things and go, okay, we can do something with this and make it work. And I think that's really the most exciting thing for me, that, you know, 4 years ago, or whenever we started all this, you know, 4 years later, here's something that's about to blossom, and it's going to be gigantic. You know, in my mind, it's like going to be enormous. And I think in the right way, though. Do you know what I mean? It's it's not premeditated. None of it's premeditated. It just came out that way.
Well, it's interesting what you were saying there. I think what happens when you get older is you recognize and learn how to understand your ego and its purposes. And when I was younger, I think I didn't know how to control it and when it was useful and when it wasn't useful. It's only, you know, the last 10 years I've realized, actually, when you're creating music and communicating with people, your ego isn't that helpful. I mean, it is at some point, you do need it, but it's really not helpful when you're being creative and trying to see, is this idea good? How's this relationship going? You know, is there some agenda between, you know? So I think as you get older, you figure that out. But bands are arguably at their peak in their 20s when they're doing the most amount of drinking and drugs. They're at, you know, they're not overthinking things. They're just instinctively working. And then they have to deal with all the fallout that happens with that, you know, with that kind of lifestyle and exhaustion. But if you can last through that and still retain that discovery within each other, you know, I'm married 30 years this year, so I still find that my wife is still surprising to me. So I don't think I really quite know her yet. And I don't know if I ever will, but that's, I find the same thing happens musically. If you kind of know what somebody else is going to do, or think you know, and aren't open for the surprise, I think it's very difficult to maintain that. And then, you know, with bands, resentments build up and all these kind of things happen. So it's a very difficult relationship. I do understand that, that these things can't exist forever. But once you get through it, it's wonderful. I mean, I worked with REM and U2, obviously, and they are people that have a crazy amount of respect for each other. And, you know, they've gotten past all those difficulties. And some people can't. I mean, I worked with the Cars, and they never seem to get over these personal, interpersonal problems. You know, it's just sad, because if you can keep it together, it's really a wonderful thing.
I thought you were going to say they can't get over the caricatures they created.
Well, that is that's a big part of it, too. That is a big part of it. I mean, strangely, that the reason why Bono did the book tour was because he... When you get famous, you do become a caricature. And there's not much you can do about it, but he did want to just, you know, change the conversation a little, and I think he managed to do that. But I think you probably find that you're both, well, I know you've written two books, and Budgie, you're in the middle of one. I imagine at the end of it, you have come to terms with your story and who you are now, and, you know, you make peace with it. It's great to hear people writing books and, you know, processing their life through it. And it seems to make peace with, and, you know, prevent these caricatures existing or to be the final voice.
Will you be a writer of your own memoir sometime?
No, I actually can't remember a thing. Do not remember anything. And I can't remember, I have no long-term memory and I have no short-term memory. I used to be very nervous about that when I started working in studios. Like, people would come to me, bands would come to me, and expect me to say, this is what we're going to do, because this is what I usually do. And every time I start a new project, I am terrified. Like, I listened to our record, and this morning on the way to the gym, and I cannot remember how we did anything. I don't remember how an idea started. And part of me was thinking, oh, damn. I think I texted both of you this morning saying, you know about the next record? Because I was just trying to get my head, is there a possibility of me remembering how we did even one song? Even coming on today, I thought, should I prepare something? And then I thought, well, I don't know what to prepare for. I don't know what to think, what to... So I can't remember anything. So every project is... It's like the opposite of Groundhog Day, that movie, where I just start the day like I can't remember yesterday. So I don't have a system or a process. So it really won't help with any memoir, because the mem in memoir might be from remember. And I can't remember anything. So... I'm not going to do it.
I think that worked in your favor, though, because, like, when we started working together, we started, like, all of us from a blank slate, no preconceptions. Like, that was your real stroke of genius there, to show us that we can just be us and it will be fine and it will work out fine.
Well, it's a bit like this. I mean, most people say they can't improvise. You know, that's most people's take on things. Or when you were talking about when you were in Peru and you had to talk for 45 minutes.
Yeah.
Most conversations, you're not planning what you're going to say. You're just reacting to the people in the room as a dialogue, or, you know, whatever dialogue is for more than two people. But that's pretty much what music should be, can be, is every day you just start talking about something else. And, you know, we've spent a long time together. I know you guys have spent a long time together. We were never bored. And conversation never dried up. So if you just say that speech is music, then you just keep going. And
you said something recently where it was almost, yes, the conversation could be quiet. There was silence as well. It wasn't like we were uncomfortable in the silence of each other. But, you know, we say, mm-hmm. I wonder what's going on. What's happening next? What's he doing over there?
That's also the benefit of, you know, having lived a little longer, because that stuff you were saying about ego, and that's weird. I mean, I've had that conversation with you, Budgie, a lot about how we work in a field where, you know, in one way you get the best results by suppressing your ego, but everything about the whole process of it otherwise is designed to make you want to exceed your ego and push it further forward. So it's like there's, it's a catch 22. You're not, if you use it too much, you're going to destroy everything. And if you don't use it enough, you're just, nobody's going to ever see it or hear it.
But it is like a superpower. You know, when they, in the movie, The Incredibles, when the baby realizes that it has superpowers, it's just doing everything.
Yeah.
And I think as you get old, you realize, like people who are great singers or, you know, virtuoso players. And when they're young, they're just playing fast and, you know, singing trills and all that kind of stuff. But it's, you just got to know when to pull it out or just hint at it. You don't have to show off. You know, it's a very, that's also getting comfortable with yourself and your abilities and, you know, getting out of the way of the music that you're making. It's not really you. It's you know, you're the conduit or the vessel for the idea. So if it becomes about you, it's a bit of a weird thing, you know. It seems less effective as a noise or a message. I mean, I'm not sure musicians' job is actual music. The noise that's made by musicians is the materialization of the job, which is discovery, you know. Or a cook. I mean, you see with people who really like cooking and then they get a job and they're an executive chef and they're not cooking, they're just kind of, I don't know, filling out paperwork. It's like doctors or musicians, you know, when you stop making music. So the job is discovery. And, you know, other people have jobs that don't give them the time to be able to explore or discover things. So that's why musicians get paid, is to do the, it's like, I'm not good at finance. So when humans get together and decide that the Department of Finance should do our collective finances, you would assume that they will do their job. And that's the same thing with musicians, is, you know, we can't all be musicians, so we, or astronauts, so, and we, a few people can go do it and do some discovery for us, tell us what it's like, come back, and show us.
Curious Creatures is created and presented by Lol Tolhurst and Budgie.
Producer, Joe Wong.
Producer and audio designer, Dan Didier.
Executive producer, Mark Cates.
Associate producer, Sophie Wild.
Digital marketing, Margie Taylor.
Art and logo design, Justin Thomas Kay.
Music production, Jackknife Lee.
Curious Creatures is on the web, and you can access us at www.curiouscreaturespodcast.com.
And you can reach us on Instagram and Facebook at Curious Creatures Official, Twitter at Cura Creatures.
To find more of the best music podcasts, visit doubleelvis.com or follow at doubleelvis on Instagram or at doubleelvis on Twitter.
Curious Creatures is a production of LXB LLC 2023.